the headlines. Informed sources say that Israeli weapons were used in the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Russia and China joined the chorus of countries that condemned the assassination of Iran's prominent nuclear scientist. And the European Union and the UK remain highly divided in their crunch Brexit talks, while Germany says the bloc does not need a deal with Britain at any price. Well, welcome to our studios here in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Informed sources say that Israeli weapons were used in the assassination of nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The sources say remnants of Israeli-made weapons were found at the site of the incident. The report comes as Iranian officials have already announced that traces of the Israeli regime's involvement were found in the assassination of Fakhrizadeh. Earlier, the secretary of Iran's Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani, said that Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was killed in a new type of complex operation. He said electronic equipment was used to carry out the assassination, and no one was present at the scene. Shamkhani said the Zionist regime committed the murder with involvement of MKO terrorists. Iran has held a funeral ceremony for newly assassinated nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in Tehran. Participating senior military officials once again vowed harsh revenge against the main perpetrators. Saman Khujri reports.
Iran has held a funeral ceremony for its top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who was assassinated near Tehran on Friday. Due to coronavirus, only senior government and military officials attended the event. Addressing the participants, Iranian Defense Minister Amir Khatami said assassinating Iranian scientists is an indication of the enemy's defeat. The defense minister vowed a crushing response to the perpetrators of the attack.
Every criminal activity, every assassination or terror will be responded. The enemies must know that they will receive a crushing response and that we will act in accordance with the order of Iran's leader, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei.
Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated after his car was ambushed in the city of Absert, east of the capital Tehran. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but he succumbed to his wounds. He had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program. This made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
History has shown that the actions of the enemies will not be left unanswered. We will take revenge. We will punish all those who ordered and those who carried out this terrorist attack.
The main perpetrators of these terrorist attacks against my father should wake up to this reality that this path will continue and his blood will make his name remain in history for good. They can do nothing.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's peaceful nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Iranian officials have vowed a crushing response to the main perpetrators of the attack against Dr. Fakhrizadeh, saying his path will continue much more resolutely than ever before. Saman Khujri, Tehran.
Russia joins the chorus in condemning the assassination of Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, calling it a terrorist act. In a statement, the Russian Foreign Ministry expressed concern over what it called the provocative nature of the move. The statement said the killing is clearly aimed at destabilizing and building up potential conflict in the region. The Kuwaiti Foreign Ministry also denounced the assassination of Iranian scientists. In a statement, Lebanon's Foreign Ministry also condemned the assassination, calling for restraint. China also slammed the killing as a violent crime.
We are shocked by the assassination and death of the Iranian scientist. The Chinese side condemns the violent crime and urges thorough investigation into it.
Foreign Ministry spokeswoman also said that Beijing opposes any act that may aggravate regional tensions and undermine regional peace and stability. Chunying urged all parties to cooperate and ease regional tensions. The Iraqi Foreign Minister Fuad Hussein slammed the killing as an act that does not contribute to supporting stability. The European Union blasted the killing as a criminal act, while Turkey called it an act of terror. Journalist and commentator Tsay Mohsen Abbas says U.S. President Donald Trump wants to get away with murders before his term ends in January.
Well, firstly, the Trump presidency obviously is coming to an end. He seems to be conceding. So there's a lot of speculation that in the last month or so, he can basically get away with murder. He has got away with murder already. We know what happened to General Soleimani, for instance, on a diplomatic mission in pure daylight. They assassinated an Iranian official. The same forces have essentially done this on Iranian soil now with the scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Whether they deny it or not is irrelevant. The fact is the deep state exists in order to create scenarios, to create situations where war or certain political engineering can be executed in the interests of the Western imperialists. Now, of course, the ramifications for the area are the same as they've been for many decades now. Ever since the Islamic Revolution has come onto the scene, it's been a game changer, and the ramifications, primarily for the illegal state of Israel, are its absolute termination.
Time now for the news review of this bulletin. Hello, welcome to the news review. Scotland's First Minister Nicola Sturgeon has declined to rule out a new vote for independence from Britain next year. Sturgeon says that she wants to see a referendum held in the early part of the next term of the new Scottish Parliament. She warned that she may go to court for permission to hold a referendum if London tries to block it. Scotland's parliamentary election is due in May 2021, and Sturgeon's National Party is expected to mandate a new independence referendum. Back in 2014, Scots voted against independence. However, Brexit and the British government's handling of the COVID-19 crisis have resulted in a new wave to push for independence from the UK. Most opinion polls show a majority now favor secession. Our correspondent from London, Syed Purizo, joins us. We also have Tommy Sheridan, a former member of the Scottish Parliament with the Socialist Party and founder of the independence group Hope Over Fear, who joins us from Glasgow. Okay, Syed, first over to you. Give us the latest that you have on this story.
The word on the ground, Kaveh, is that the Scottish independence has never been so popular, and that the very existence of this union of England, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Scotland, of the United Kingdom, has never been so vulnerable. And that's what's at stake with these consecutive polls that you also briefly mentioned, conducted by the likes of YouGov, Ipsos, and others, that have found that support for the Scottish independence is in the lead. These are the numbers they have come up with are the highest that have ever been recorded, and it is something that has to be taken very seriously. It is also being called as a warning to Westminster, to number 10 Downing Street, that is very serious, that they have to take it very seriously, that Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister of Scotland, is winning the so-called argument. And the message to the British Prime Minister seems to be clear, that these polls are really speaking for themselves. There have also been polls on the popularity of Nicola Sturgeon and the popularity of the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson, and how they have been handling the COVID situation, the pandemic, and the numbers really are self-explanatory. The question that folks in Scotland have been answering in those polls is the same question that was put to them in 2014. Should Scotland be independent? Excluding those who said don't know, 58% have said yes, compared to the 42% who responded in the negative, which is a record high number compared to 2014, where the first referendum was held. But people are saying, you know what, polls do not bring you independence. What is going to happen is Nicola Sturgeon, in the May parliamentary elections, will have to secure a majority. Even if she doesn't, some are saying, she will probably be helped by the Greens, pro-independence party, to get her over the line, to get that mandate that she needs, to call number 10 Downing Street and tell them, I have the mandate, now I need your approval, your green light, to hold a second referendum to break away from the UK, Kaveh.
So, Tommy Sheridan, should Scotland vote for secession, vote for independence?
Absolutely, and it's important to add to what your correspondent in London has already said. The unprecedented nature of the opinion polls should not in any way be underestimated. There have now been 14 successive opinion polls indicating the majority of Scots want independence. The support for independence in those polls among young people, those under the age of 35, is over 77%. This is a movement whose day is coming. The truth is, we are already halfway out of the British Union. Britain, per se, is dying. All that has to be arranged now is the funeral. Because once Scotland has its independence, I don't think Ireland will be far behind us in relation to unity of that island at long last. We have now momentum behind us. And all of those polls which I have just mentioned, all of them, indicate the SNP will not just win the May elections next year, they will win those elections with a romping majority. That means independence next year will be on the agenda. The only criticism I have of the SNP is that they're dragging their feet in calling the referendum. We talk about mandates. It's very important. Just this final point. The mandate for Indate Ref 2 will not appear next May. It already exists. The SNP won the 2015 general election, 2017 general election, 2019 general election, and the 2016 Scottish Parliament election. All of those victories were mandates for Indate Ref 2. The Scottish Parliament has voted twice to hold Indate Ref 2. So the mandate exists. All that will happen next May is there will be a reinforcement of the existing mandate. And the appeal I have, Nicola Sturgeon and the SNP, is get on with it and let's get out of this sinking disaster, which is Boris's Britain.
Okay. All right, so Saeed, what Tommy Sheridan there said, obviously many dimensions. I wish we could discuss it further. But quickly, if you can, I mean, not familiar with the rules. I'm guessing there are some out there who aren't either. And that is if Nicola Sturgeon comes and tells 10 Downing Street, we want to go for the secession, can Downing Street prevent this from happening?
Well, one thing that she has been asked to do is to sort of go ahead and say that they're going to hold the referendum and wait for Downing Street to respond, to legally challenge it. Now, whether or not they can do it, they probably can. I'm not very well versed on British law at the moment, but I am aware that she's getting calls from different quarters of the different political parties who are pro-independent in Scotland, calling on her to have a plan B, have some sort of a strategy. Uh-huh. To move forward if and she continues
okay, so
to get that negative
answer. Sorry to jump in then, because of lack of time, let me ask Tom Sheridan that question. Can 10 Downing Street prevent Nicola Sturgeon's drive for secession, if that happens?
That question depends on which lawyer you ask. You see, the 1707 Act of the Union was a voluntary act. It is not part of a written constitution. There is not a rule in that voluntary union which says that you can never leave. This isn't the Hotel California that you can check out any time but never leave. We have to say quite clearly that, of course, as a sovereign nation, Scotland was sovereign for hundreds of years before we joined the Act of Union of 1707. Of course we have the right to self-determination. And that's what should be put to the test. We don't need permission. How dare Westminster say that we need permission in order to get our independence?
Okay.
We're an adult nation. We're a mature nation. We'll take our own decisions.
All right.
We will politely inform Westminster, but we don't ask permission.
Okay, I'm going to squeeze this question. You talk very passionately about going for independence. Is the majority of Scots also as passionate as you are, Tommy Sheridan?
I think it's quite clear now. The polls, all of them, are showing around 55%. Some of them are showing 59%. And the campaign hasn't even started. In 2013, support for independence was around 25%. That's why the Tories agreed to what's called a Section 30 order to allow a referendum to take place, because they thought there was no chance of Scotland voting for it. And yet, support for independence went from 25 to 45%. We're not starting off at 25%. We're starting off at 55%. We're going to win 60%+ support for independence. Britain is dead. Let's announce the funeral.
Thank you for that. Very enthusiastic, Tommy Sheridan. We do appreciate all that information and your comments and insight. As always, thank you for giving us an update on this. And that does it for the News Review. Thanks for tuning in. Welcome back. In Sudan, flags are flying at half staff after former Prime Minister Sadiq al-Mahdi died of COVID-19 at the age of 84. He was a leading political figure in Sudan who was well known for his anti-Israeli policies. From Khartoum, Muhammad Ali Fazari has more.
Tens of thousands of Sudanese have bid farewell to their last democratically elected Prime Minister, who died of COVID-19-related complications at 84. According to the National Umma Party, which he led until his death, Sadiq al-Mahdi died in hospital in the United Arab Emirates, where he was receiving treatment after becoming infected with the novel coronavirus in October.
I think the loss of the Sadiq al-Mahdi, the Umma Party leader and the Sudanese, the most intellectual person in the Sudanese political process, is so great loss. It will be reflecting on all and hold the political process.
Imam Sadiq is greatest one in the Sudan, and this is era need him. Why? Because according to the government,
al-Mahdi served as a prime minister in the mid 60s and again in the mid 80s before he was overthrown in a coup of 1989, which led to rise power of President Omar al-Bashir. After being forced out of office, al-Mahdi remained a leading politician in Sudan. In a statement, Sudan Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok described him as one of the most important figures of thought, politics, literature, and wisdom in the country. Meanwhile, senior National Umma Party said that the party will continue to follow the anti-Israel policies taken by the late Sadiq al-Mahdi.
We have our own doctrine based on the Islamic ethics. We are against the normalization. If the needs arise, not Al Burhan, neither Hamdok will decide on behalf of the Sudanese people. The coming elected parliament will decide on the behalf of the Sudanese nation.
I think this constitution will go in the same road of the leader Sadiq al-Mahdi in the normalization, against the normalization or any establishment of the relationship between the Sudan and Israel.
Al-Mahdi was a well-known Sudanese political figure who played an important role in public affairs and wrote several books addressing the situation in Sudan.
For more than 60 decades, Sadiq al-Mahdi was an icon of democracy, Islamic thought, and a strong opponent of imperialism in Sudan and abroad. Muhammad Fazari, from Khartoum, Twin City of Omdurman.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib on Tuesday, November 24th, became the first sitting members of Congress to join a new pressure campaign demanding that Joe Biden keep Bruce Reed, an unapologetic architect of Bill Clinton's disastrous welfare reform and notorious austerity proponent, out of the White House. A longtime Democratic operative who has advised and worked for Biden for years, Reed helped craft the 1996 welfare reform law that produced a massive surge in extreme poverty, inflicting severe damage on vulnerable children. Reed, who in 2016 characterized the law as an overall success, has also been credited with authoring Clinton's infamous vow to end welfare as we know it. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Jake Johnson Ryder. This article is published under the heading AOC, Omar and Tlaib Back Effort to Keep Deficit Hawks Out of Biden Administration. Stay tuned, please, for the details of this article. Representatives Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Ilhan Omar, and Rashida Tlaib on Tuesday, November 24th, became the first sitting members of Congress to join a new pressure campaign, demanding that Joe Biden keep Bruce Reed, an unapologetic architect of Bill Clinton's disastrous welfare reform and notorious austerity proponent, out of the White House. The No Deficit Hawks petition, launched by advocacy group Justice Democrats and backed by other progressive organizations, comes as Reed is reportedly under consideration to lead Biden's Office of Management and Budget, or OMB, a key agency that will be tasked with crafting the incoming administration's budgetary agenda amid a devastating economic crisis. Putting someone who will prioritize paying down the deficit ahead of all the concerns in charge is a recipe for cutting our earned benefits and turning the COVID recession into a depression, the petition states. Rejecting Reid will be a major test for the soul of the Biden presidency. A longtime Democratic operative who has advised and worked for Biden for years, Reed helped craft the 1996 welfare reform law that produced a massive surge in extreme poverty, inflicting severe damage on vulnerable children. Reid, who in 2016 characterized the law as an overall success, has also been credited with authoring Clinton's infamous vow to end welfare as we know it. In the wake of the American Prospects report last week that Reid is under consideration to head OMB, progressives spotlighted Reid's role as executive director of the Bowles-Simpson Commission, an Obama administration initiative that recommended slashing Social Security benefits. Social Security Works, one of the backers of the new petition, said it is imperative to keep Reid and his toxic austerity politics out of the Biden administration. Omar echoed that message in a tweet on Tuesday, November 24th, declaring, "If the Biden administration is serious about protecting Medicare and Social Security, they must not appoint one of the biggest champions of cuts to lead their budget agency." Other signatories of the new petition include the Working Families Party and Data for Progress, as well as Representatives-elect Corey Bush and Jamal Bowman, incoming progressive members who have also spoken out against the Biden's team, reported consideration of former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel for a White House role. Bruce Reid helped develop the 94 crime bill, pushed broken windows, policing, and cuts to Social Security and Medicaid, which tweeted on Tuesday, November 24th. "We want an administration that prioritizes programs that protect all of us. Mr. Reid is not someone our communities trust." Although progressives have lauded Biden's decision to nominate Janet Yellen for Treasury Secretary and appoint Ron Klain as Chief of Staff, prominent leftist voices have expressed wariness that Biden might pick Bruce Reid, a former Biden Chief of Staff, to head the Office of Management and Budget, that is OMB. "We are extremely concerned by the reports that Reid is a front runner to head the Office of Management and Budget under the Biden administration, given his history of antipathy towards economic security programs that working people rely on," the representative said in the petition they co-signed, also with other progressive leaders. With more administration staff announcements pending, Biden told Holt the team was focused on coordinating a transition, noting that the Trump administration's outreach has been sincere. "They're already working out my ability to get presidential daily briefs," he told the Holt. "We are already working out meeting with COVID team in the White House and how to not only distribute, but get from a vaccine being distributed to a person being able to get vaccinated," he added.
Everyone, this is John. You are with me for another episode of our weekly show, The Subcontinent. Our program focuses on few of the most critical, sensitive, and important issues in the subcontinent, which is a region which hosts almost 25% of the global population. So let's dive into our segment, break down issues, take expert opinion, and see what people say.
In this edition of the Subcontinent, we shall look into India's railway privatization. Also, we will explore the pros and cons of this bumpy road.
India's government is moving ahead with its privatization initiative in many spheres. Now, it is time for the Indian Railways. The Indian Railways is the third largest railway network in the world by size, with a route length of about 70,000 kilometers. It has always been the network that connects India, but opening it to private investors may make it less available for most of the people.
The privatization of Indian railways has been recommended for many decades, but recently the government officially started the process to allow private firms to operate passenger trains on its network via 151 new trains. This marks the beginning of private sector participation in passenger train operations. Last year, the government decided that the Indian Railways will restructure all its 7 production units and associated workshops, including like ICF Perambur, RCF Kapurthula, Modern Coach Factory and Raibareli, into a cooperation called Indian Railways Roll Stocking Company. The railways is not the only sector Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government is opening to the corporates. The government has already invited the private firms to other sectors like coal mines, banks, defence, oil, insurance, electricity, telecom, space and atomic energy.
They are selling off the public sector, big factories and institutions. Even the railways are being privatised. One train has been sold. And the people working on that train have to work for 18 hours of the day. They have fallen sick. This is the future that they are showing.
The process has its own merits and demerits, as experts say the measure is a clash between the consequences of the need for modernization versus social obligations.
A few weeks ago, in early July 2020, the Railway Ministry announced that 151 trains in 109 pair of routes will be operated by private sectors with a 30,000 crore rupees investment. There are ideas and people both in favor and against the plan. Some see privatization as the way forward, and some mention the unfavorable outcomes that may follow the move.
Although the initial phase of the privatization would cover a small part of the entire railway network, liberalizing the entry of new operators in the public transport may be the path for improving services and facilitating growth of the sector. Those in favor of the project believe fares in private trains will be competitive, and the introduction of private players would eventually increase the number of trains, ensuring high availability on demand and punctuality. The proponents argue that privatization means higher quality of services, which can help India renovate its fleet and accommodate the latest technology in railways, coaches, safety and travelling experience. They say privatization will lead to better infrastructure, which in turn would lead to improved safety, reduction in travel time and etc. Indian railway services are marred by issues like lack of punctuality, mismanagement in the form of stinking washrooms, lack of water supply and dirty platforms. Privatization may solve these issues, as the move would foster competition and hence lead to overall betterment in the quality of services. Thereby, it may help Indian Railways to become a world-class network, but some believe it may simply backfire.
The proponents of privatization say that it creates jobs and fosters modernization. But those on the other side argue that only the driver and guard will be railway employees. All other employees will be part of the private company who has won the contract to operate the train. The private companies are free to procure train and locomotives from any source of their choice. This may be a threat to national production and self-reliance.
Opponents of India's privatization of railways speak of numerous limitations for the project, including increased fares and disconnecting some less trodden parts of the country. Not unexpectedly, private enterprise runs on profit, and the easiest way to profit from their investment may be to hike fares. The huge increase in the ticket fare would render the service beyond the reach of lower-income groups and destroy the initial purpose of the railways, which is meant to serve the entire population irrespective of the level of income. An advantage of government-owned railways is that it provides nationwide connectivity to bring regional development. This would not continue with privatization because routes which are less popular, hence less profitable, may be neglected. This can have a negative impact on connectivity. Some parts of the country, including regions with rugged terrain and low population density, like Himalayan states and northeastern states, may become virtually inaccessible. Privatization may drop them out of the process of development.
Another concern about the plan is the confusion on land titles and land use as the properties are dated. The railways company says that there is no change required in the regulations to carry out the project, but local authorities in many places do not agree to it. Most of the stations are located in the crowded and old parts of the cities, away from the new infrastructure. To make the project commercially viable, a holistic plan for the development of the entire catchment area is required, instead of just the standalone station plan. According to the data maintained by the World Bank, in 2018, India had 68,443 kilometers of route of railways. It is among the four largest rail networks in the world, along with the United States, China, and Russia. Although every kilometer of track in India covers geographical area much less than Germany, Russia, China, or Canada, indicating scope for expansion.
If the privatization of Asia's oldest railway is implemented as planned, modern trains will be added to the network, which needs heavy investment in rolling stock like coaches and engines. Moreover, there is the cost of operations, which includes electricity, manpower, and all other equipment. Such a scenario means all the facilities should be upgraded with better onboard services and faster trains. Who's going to pay this huge modernization expense? The railways company, private investors, or people? The plan enables investors to make money either by monetizing land and airspace by setting up shops, kiosks, advertisement hoardings, parking lots, offices, and residential properties. The sector is already in decline and losing business to other modes like air and road. Operating passenger trains is a loss-making business for Indian Railways. It recovers only around 57% of the cost through tickets on an average. The rest is cross-subsidized through earnings from its freight operations.
All right, gentlemen, our team has collected a few media coverages in this regard, which we would really appreciate if you could take a look. So let's just get to the media and then we can come back to the question and answer session. Please stay with us.
Asia's oldest rail network will invite applications for modernizing stations across the country every month. But for that, Indian Railways will have to overcome delays, streamline approvals, and cut red tape, things that derailed the effort earlier. But drawing interest from the private sector for station upgrade has been harder than thought, as delays and stringent conditions made it unviable. Envisioned in 2004 to 2005, the project failed to take off. Modi renewed it in 2016 with a plan to redevelop 400 stations. Immediately after the announcement, as usual, the Bucks started welcoming the decision of the government. Unfortunately, in our country, the mainstream of the media, instead of speaking the truth without fear, has been reduced to being drum beaters of the present government. The government continues its loyalty to the interests of the corporate sector, and the common people's interests are always buried. It is estimated that almost 70% of freight trains, which now jostle for space with passenger trains on the overcrowded Indian railway network, will shift to the two upcoming dedicated freight corridors from December 2021. This will free up a lot of capacity to introduce more passenger trains with better services and higher speeds.
Now, for more analysis, let me welcome our guest to the show, Mr. Mohan Guruswamy, the chairman of Center for Policy Alternative and a former advisor to the Indian Finance Minister, Yashwant Sinha. We also have with us Mr. Raghunandan, who is with the Delhi Science Forum, a non-profit think tank. Let's start with Mr. Guruswamy. Mr. Guruswamy, are we expecting a privatization of the Indian Railways?
Such a thing, let me tell you, is practically impossible. For a start, it's the biggest railway system in the world. It's got over 1.2 million employees. And it runs at a loss. It's hugely subsidized. Privatization would imply that somebody has to come and buy it, and it has to run profitably. It won't happen because a lot of the economy rides on the cheap movement of people from place to place. For instance, migrant labor. Millions move every year from different parts of India to work in the big cities, and they go back in the off season. They travel on the subsidized railway. Even passengers and commercial travelers who travel use the subsidized benefit. The cost of passengers is subsidized by the freight. Railway freight is now becoming very expensive. Now, the problem with having the existing system is the people who are willing to spend lots of money for the luxury of train travel are unable to do so because the railways are just not able to maintain high-class railway travel because they're subsidizing the poorer passengers. Here, what is going to happen for the first time is that the coaches are going to be owned, the stock is going to be owned by private parties, and they're going to operate it on the railway system, pay the railways for use of track, pay the railways for use of signaling, pay the railways for use of railway platforms, and all that. But this does not mean that all passenger trains will be privatized. It's impossible, cannot happen, and nobody would want to invest money in something which is loss-making. And private railways, besides their experience, has not been good anywhere in the world. In the US, you hardly have any private railway systems, and the ones which function, barely function. In Britain, it has been a huge failure after Margaret Thatcher privatized them. So it won't happen in India. I don't think it can happen in India, nor will it happen in India.
So, Mr. Raghunandan, what do you think?
Well, the privatization is taking place in bits and pieces. There is privatization of 400 main railway stations compared to thousands of railway stations in the country. There is privatization of a few selected routes, premium routes, but which are medium length routes. They are being handed over to private players. And there is privatization of some services like catering, food services on trains. So, broadly speaking, I agree that this is not privatization of the railways in the sense it is understood in Europe or the UK, for example. The entire railways are not being privatized, but there are parts of the railways, bits of it, which are being privatized.
Okay, staying with you, Mr. Raghunandan. So, who will benefit from all of this?
The way it is structured now, the only benefits will be the private concessionaires who will be given these different sectors or railway stations or whatever it is to run. They will benefit. The passengers as a whole, I don't see them benefiting because, number one, all the services, rail services, trains which are being privatized are premium services which cater to only a very small percentage of the population.
All right. So, Mr. Guruswamy, how would these plans have an impact on the ordinary Indians, the working class, the migrant workers?
They could benefit to the extent that, there'd be more coaches available for them, for their regular trains. That is for a start. And the other thing is that, already right now you have coaches reserved for upper classes. And it's actually quite sad to see miserable conditions in the lower class and fairly comfortable travel in the upper class. So you won't have that. You won't have a class system, probably in the future.
All right, Mr. Raghunandan. Mr. Guruswamy said that there are miserable conditions for the poor and there's a class difference, a clear class difference that we see. Do you agree?
Yeah. So the argument you were giving that since these privatized trains will cater to the higher paying passengers, that will vacate a certain number of seats which will then be available to the lower classes, doesn't apply. Because what they are going to do is the already premium services of the railways are going to be privatized with a few add-on luxuries such as onboard Wi-Fi or something like that, for which passengers will be charged a little even more than the premium prices they are paying now. So the seats vacated will not filter down to the lower classes at all, because the lower classes travel on very different trains and in very different coaches.
Mr. Raghunandan, could you please elaborate more on that?
Yeah. 90% of railway passengers in India travel by what is called second class or lower categories, which are non-air conditioned, not particularly comfortable trains. They are meant for the average traveler. 90% of India, especially including the poor and the lower middle class and the working class, travel by these trains and these coaches. There are trains which are intercity trains which connect different major cities with the capital and so on, which are completely air-conditioned even now. And obviously, the poorer classes will not travel by those trains. Now, what are being privatized now in services are fully air-conditioned trains only. These are the ones being privatized because this is only where the private concessionaires can make profit. So the average user of the Indian railways will remain untouched. In that sense, I think the poorer classes will lose because they will have less priority from the government. And of course, they have no role to play as far as the private sector is concerned, because private sector will not make any money from these people.
All right, gentlemen, our team has collected a few media coverages in this regard, which we would really appreciate if you could take a look. So let's just get to the media and then we can come back to the question answer session. Please stay with us.
Several committees have gone into the expansion and the modernization of Indian railways. In 2015, the expert panel chaired by Bibek Debroy, constituted by the Ministry of Railways a year earlier, recommended that the way forward for the railways was liberalization and not privatization in order to allow entry of new operators, to encourage growth and improve services. It also made it clear that a regulatory mechanism was a prerequisite to promote healthy competition and protect the interests of all stakeholders. The way privatization will affect the masses is not a question that we have to concern ourselves, well, at least in the long run. It is true that the decision is reflective of the government's effort to cut its losses given the abhorrent financial discredit suffered on account of the pandemic. As far as investment opportunities are concerned, there is value for investing these companies, as is well substantiated by their large market cap and stable financials. After missing several completion targets in the past, the Dedicated Freight Corridor Corporation of India Limited has now been given a fresh timeline ending June 2022, which appears to be a Herculean task given its snail's pace of the past. Though progress in the Dedicated Freight Corridors project is abysmally slow, the completion of the Dedicated Goods Corridor is crucial for the success of the part privatization of passenger and freight services. It is like when private banks were set up in India,
So many private players came in the banking sector, but that didn't lead SBI to shut. Private investment will bring in newer technologies. It will create competition in the railway sector. Competition will increase efficiency and reduce fare in the long run, Niti Aayog CEO Amitabh Kant said. The move is being criticized by many political associations as they term it an anti-poor move. There are chances, but as for now, these trains are not going to affect the poor as the railways will still be running 95% of total trains once these private trains start operation in full swing. However, if the government decides to go for further privatization of the sector, then it may create problems for the commoners.
All right, gentlemen, welcome back. Let's dive straight in. So, Mr. Guruswamy, recalling back what Mr. Raghunandan said, that the average person will not even be touched by the benefits that will ensue. So, can having more players involved help improve the system, or will it be detrimental?
Well, nobody will come into the low-cost travel segment. So that is where the mass volume is, and that's where 95% of the traffic is. This is a very niche segment at the top. You know, there are limits to how many airports you can have, how much of air travel you can have. So this is very niche, and this is an experiment. Let's see how it goes. One or two routes they're going to try, one or two trains they're going to try. And let's see how it works. But nobody can afford to run trains at the cost Indian Railways does. That is the point I'm making.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen, for joining us and for the wonderful conversation. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have. And let's hope all of these end up to the benefit of the Indian nation and not only for the rich. Now we have some social media opinions and then we can conclude. Thank you.
The account of the National Students' Union of India believes that as the backbone of the country's economy, privatization of railways will have a considerable effect on the whole economy. Surav Prasad also believes that privatization is not necessary, especially when the government-owned system is not based on gaining profit, in which he sees it as an advantage of this model. The official account of the youth wing of Indian National Congress strongly criticizes the government for leaving young railway apprentices without jobs by privatizing the sector. ANI quoted from the Railway Board Chairman Vinod Kumar Yadav as saying that the private trains will start servicing by April 2023. On the other hand, Jairam Ramesh believes that this policy will not succeed as it has not worked in any other country.
And that was our episode covering the issue of Indian railway privatization. We'll meet next week.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.